Okay, today we are going to talk about quantitative genetics and quantitative traits. And really, when we talk about quantitative traits, we're dealing with traits that are encoded by alleles on multiple loci. And so much of the time that we've been talking about either Mendelian or transmission genetics at the beginning and then molecular genetics, we've really been focusing on the roles of a single locus, an allele at a single locus, where you've got, in the case of Mendelian genetics, dominant and recessive relationships. And molecular genetics is just a matter of, is it expressed, is it not expressed, to what extent is it expressed. Now we're going to be talking about some of these traits that are encoded by many loci. And in fact, these are the ones that kind of make you who you are as a person. If we were focusing strictly on human genetics, you know, the fact that you have a glycosyl transferase gene doesn't really make you special. Pretty much everybody in this room has a glycosyl transferase gene, and it's essential. But when we look around the room, many of the traits that distinguish individuals are quantitative traits, that there are multiple alleles at multiple loci. And so what tends to happen is you don't get this either-or situation, that you get a range of variability on that trait. And so you have the option of a large number of genotypes. Okay? There's variation in these, a greater amount of variation in quantitative traits because you have a larger number of possible genotypes. And that's an important concept. You may want to write that one down and remember it because there's a good chance you're going to see that one again. Okay, so the more loci you have, the more possible genotypes that you have, the greater the variability in phenotype you can have. So this is a discontinuous characteristic. This is one where, when I was referring to either or. So like in the pea plants in Darwin, you had either tall or short plants. Okay, there's not much range. You're either tall or you're short. Okay, and there's a distinctive phenotype for each. This is a continuous characteristic. It's called continuous because if we plot it out, the discontinuous, oh, you got a block for tall, you got a block for dwarf. There's not really any intermediates. With this plant, you see we've got some short ones, we've got some tall ones, we've got some of these in the middle of height. If we plot that population out, then we see this continuous curve. And curves are big things to scientists. I remember sitting in a calculus class, and so I had the misfortune of taking calculus in an engineering program, and calculus was their dropout class for mechanical engineers. And to show how much they really wanted to put you through the ringer, calculus was Tuesday, Thursday, Saturday, 7:30 a.m. lectures. So, yeah. And then, you know, they gave you the talk at the beginning. Look to your left. Look to your right. One of you is not going to be here by the halfway point of this class. So that's always a great thing. If a professor ever tells you that, throw something at them. Because that means they've given up on a third of you the first day of class. Anyway, but this guy, he actually was a pretty good, engineer. He went to school with Neil Armstrong was his classmate. But he said the cheesiest thing one day, and it is, you know, you learn about all this graphing, but curves are where it's at. The universe manifests itself as a gentle curving smile. Just like at 7:30 on a Saturday morning, he uncorks this thing. Curves are really what happen in nature. For the most part, we see continuous traits. And so that's the type of thing that we're going to talk about today. Normal curves, where as you get closer to the mean, that you get more representative members within the population. As you go out to the extremes, there are fewer and fewer. But we'll see some curves where they can be bell-shaped, but they can be kind of squat. We'll have other bell-shaped curves where they're kind of pointy, where there's very little range. But if it's a continuous characteristic, they should have this bell-shaped curve within the same generation. Okay. Now, this is just showing in that hypothetical example how you could get this range of height in this continuous characteristic. What they're saying is there are three loci for height in that plant. Okay, and at each of these loci, there are two possible alleles, the tall allele and the short allele. Okay, so one allele will promote growth. One of them will not promote extra growth from the short version of the plant. The more height-adding alleles that you have, the taller the plant will be. And so it looks at the possible plant genotypes. And so in this scenario, 10 centimeters is the minimum base height. If you have none of those genes, this plant will be at least 10 centimeters in height. So here's an example of the one possible genotype in which you have none of the alleles that will add height to the plant. There are three possible genotypes in which you get one copy of a height-adding gene. Here we've got there are six genotypes here in which you would get two. There are seven that you would get three. Seven that you get three, six that you would get four, three that you would get five, and one that you would get six. So if we look, we've got seven is the maximal, and that's at three of the six. And then you've got, three and four would be the same, two and five would be the same, one and six. No, sorry, it's zero and six, one and five, three and four, two and four and three. All right, so what this is just showing is graphically that range of the possible genotypes, it really comes down to how many copies of those height-adding genes that you have. Okay? And it's an additive effect. The more copies of those you have, the taller you will be as a plant, but it's less likely that you will inherit either zero or all six. Okay? You have to have parents that have the configurations that would allow for these to happen. And if you've got parents that have at least one height-adding gene on each of their chromosomes involved in here, it's very unlikely that you're going to get zero. Okay? So the range of genotypes is what provides us with that continuous characteristic of the phenotype. Okay? And then we'll, let's see if we've got, no, okay. So in humans, we'll talk about then height in humans as an example, and then also pigmentation. Those are the strongest continuous characteristics in humans. Mentioned the other day that height is the example of positive assortive mating, particularly among females. But there's a situation where it probably best guess right now is there are between 12 and 16 alleles that play an important part in human height. And so if you have tall parents, it becomes more likely that you are going to be taller as a kid. Okay? But we talked about when we looked at the recombination mapping, sorry to bring back ugly memories, but the same genotype behaves much differently if all of the dominant alleles are on one chromosome or on another. All right. So we'll say that you've got, we'll just break it down to eight loci for height to make it easy. Okay. And we'll say that your dad's a fairly tall guy, and dad has, so with eight loci, you've got 16 total alleles. We'll say that your dad has 12 of them. Okay. So if there are eight loci, there's a lot of different configurations that you can have that way. Dad could have four loci where both of them are filled up, and then four with singles. You can have more individual ones. There's some variation as to how they pair up with respect to if both or one copy will be a height-adding chromosome. and we'll say that your mom's maybe not that tall and mom only has 6. Okay? So there's a possibility of 18 that you can get, but if there are 8 loci and mom's got 6, there is a chance that mom has a height-adding loci or allele on all 6. Okay? She may not double up on any one of them. Okay? If dad's got height-adding alleles on both copies of the same loci, you're only going to inherit one of those from dad. Right? You're not going to inherit both of them. But if mom's got her 6 height-adding alleles are spread out, there's a chance that you could inherit all 6 from mom, depending on how they're distributed. So even if we could go in and test, if you've got really tall parents, depending on how those alleles are distributed, there's a chance that you won't be that tall yourself. Okay? So you get a range, even from tall parents, you get a range of height, depending on the distribution of the alleles at the loci, not just their presence or absence. Okay? The other thing with height that people tend to forget about is there is a dimorphism in humans, that males tend to be taller, everything else being equal. A male with 8 height-adding alleles will be taller than a female with 8 height-adding alleles. Males continue to grow later into life, and so genetically, the same genotype between males and females will not produce the same average height. That males, on average, are 4 inches taller than females in the U.S. And so sometimes if you look at parents, there's a misunderstanding of where the height-adding genes are coming from. So a couple of basically the same height, the mother has more copies of the height-adding gene. So a 5'10" woman in this example would probably have 13 out of 16. I mean, she would be at the taller end of the range. A 5'10" male would probably have 8. That would be average in the U.S. right now is 5'9 to 5'10 for males. And so that couple can have kids that are fairly tall because the mom is carrying a lot of height-adding genes. I mentioned the other day that I was going to use my kids as an example. Their mom is 6 foot tall. I'm 5'10". She's got about 5 to 10% of the female population that's taller than her, so she's carrying a lot of these height-adding alleles around. I probably only have about 8 since I'm right at about average, and my kids are going to tower above me. So my daughter is almost 5'9" at age 12. She sent her on her basketball team, but she's just not mean enough, unfortunately. She doesn't know what elbows are used for inside on rebounding yet. So, and you would never guess that I would have a kid that wasn't mean, but she's far too nice. And then my son, boys tend to grow at a slower rate early in life. And so when and if you decide to have kids, or in Alan Katz's world, you get married, decide to have kids, when you take them to the pediatrician, they weigh them, measure them, and then they will give you a curve showing their percentile with height, weight, and head size, which I was never expecting. The head size, apparently, early in my life, both of my kids were strong candidates to be the new generation's mascot for Jack in the Box because they all had ginormous heads. They looked like popsicles the first several months of their lives. Lollipops. But you may have a kid that doesn't look that big to you, and then they all of a sudden tell you, well, your kid's tracking at the 85th percentile. And in my household, my daughter has always been taller than my son at the same age point. But percentile-wise, they track about the same, and that's just because girls hit their growth spurts earlier in life, so a tall girl in fourth grade will be taller than a tall boy in fourth grade, that kind of stuff. But it comes down to the number of alleles at those loci for how tall you'll be when you manifest, but in terms of passing it on, the distribution of how those things are spread out at those alleles will determine the range of the height that you can have as kids, or you will have in your kids. Same type of thing with pigment color, that there are multiple loci with multiple alleles for the production of melanin in skin. And so you have some people that very dark complected, they produce a lot of melanin. You've got some people, again, I'll pick on my son, he is the pastiest human on the face of the planet. He would disappear if I held him up here. You would just see blonde hair and blue eyes looking out at you like the Cheshire Cat if I put my son in front of this whiteboard. And it's the same type of thing, that you can go from zero additive. There's a base level of the amount of melanin that you will always produce, and there's a maximum amount that you can produce, and you can have a wide range. You can have a couple that have two individuals that are right in the middle of the curve in terms of melanin production, and they can, if they've got the right arrangement of those alleles, they can have kids that go from everything from pasty like my son to very dark. Okay. The other extreme would be if you have somebody with very dark pigmentation, somebody with light pigmentation, their offspring will tend to cluster in the middle because you're going to have one parent that, since they're so dark, that they're going to have the melanin-producing alleles. They're going to pass most of those along. The other one won't have many. They're not going to pass many along, and so their kids will tend to cluster in the middle. So a couple in the middle will tend to have kids of a range of melanin. Couples at the extreme will tend to have kids that cluster in the middle. Okay. But again, the greater the number of loci, the greater the number of genotypes possible, the greater the variation. So something with two or three loci will be less variable than one with eight or one with 16 loci. Okay, that will always be the case. Meristic characteristics. So another thing about height is it's a meristic characteristic. So it's it just means that there are multiple genetic factors, but also environmental factors. So if you've got certain plants that they can do tall or short in some condition, but if you move them to better conditions, tall means something different, short means something else. The best example is litter size in animal. So you use a whole number. You don't have half a pup being born. And so you can look at the average litter size and then determine, you know, if you guys have had ecology yet, you appreciate that fecundity and litter size is a huge measurement in ecology in terms of fitness. If an organism has better resources and they're healthy, they tend to have better litter size. But it's a meristic characteristic. Threshold characteristics tend to be measured by either the presence or absence, and oftentimes we're thinking in terms of a disease state or a less than optimal state. But what we see with threshold events is they tend to be continuous characteristics. And it's just once you hit a threshold point that you've got an outcome that's distinguishable. So in this case, this is the susceptibility to disease. You hit a threshold. We would say that beyond here is the disease state. This isn't, you know, if you're one pixel over this line compared to an individual that's one pixel under this line, your values aren't that different. Okay. But there's this threshold at which we say, oh, this is a disease state, this isn't. If your blood sugar is 99 or whatever, sorry, that depends on how they're measuring it these days. If your blood sugar is 134, you're not diabetic. If it's 135, you are diabetic depending at a certain age. That's a threshold event. There's not much difference between them. There's this continuous flow in the population with respect to blood sugar values, but we make this arbitrary line in which we say it's a disease state. Somebody right here is probably going to have problems too. Okay. So with a threshold event, it's often a matter, it's often an arbitrary assignment that's made with a continuous population. And it gives the illusion, if you're reading about it, that it's actually a discontinuous trait. Okay. All right, so just some types of quantitative characteristics. Polygenic. Okay, this is what we've been talking about with like height, that it's an additive effect or a cumulative effect. The more copies that you have, the taller you'll be. The example that your book gives you is kernel color in wheat. And so wheat can be anything from sort of a bleached out blonde color to a really dark red, almost purple color. And again, it's determined by the number of alleles that encode for pigment production. Okay. So if you've got a really light one that doesn't have any, and you've got this one that's got four, all the offspring will have two. There'll be an intermediate color. Okay. But then if you cross that F1 generation, you'll have several possible genotypes. And so you can go from purple to dark red to light red, then to white. And again, it's just determined by the number of those alleles that encode for pigmentation. Okay. So within two generations, you've got this range of colors from crossing the two extremes. Okay. Okay, so for a polygenic characteristic, if you know how many genes are involved in it, you can predict how many types of possible outcomes that you would have. But I'm not going to have you do the math. Again, the concept that I want you to know is, the greater the number of loci involved, the greater the number of possible genotypes, the greater the variation. Okay. But this is just demonstrating that mathematically. If you've got a single locus, you're going to have something that's very blocky in nature. If you've got two loci, when you do a dihybrid cross, then you're going to have five possible outcomes. Here's five loci. We're starting to get something that starts to resemble a curve at this point, and then by the time that you throw a large number of loci, that you start filling in these gaps with more intermediate values. Okay? So, and if we go more and more loci out here, we get something that resembles a gentle curve that would keep my calculus prof happy through the winter time. Okay. And with distributions, quantitative genetics is probably the field in which you brush up on kind of hardcore stats the most. Bioinformatics, genomics does it quite a bit, but quantitative geneticists are essentially statisticians that just work on a biological trait. Diane Byers in biological sciences considers herself most days a quantitative geneticist, but at her heart, she's a mathematician that does a lot of stats. So one of the things that you use to analyze is just distribution. So the frequency, how close the trait is to a normal distribution or a bell-shaped curve. So again, the type of thing that we've been looking at, this would be a distribution curve. How many members of the population exhibit what traits? So this would be body weight. So the height of the bar represents the number of individuals. And as we move over, presumably we're going from lighter to heavier. Okay, so you would have like 10-pound units or blocks of weight, and you look at a population and you determine how many people weigh, 90 to 100 pounds, how many people weigh 100 to 110, and then you graph that out and you get a distribution curve of the entire population. Okay. the greater the number of people that you include in a population curve, the more accurate it will be, and generally the less blocky it will look. Okay? If you only get 8 people and you do this, and you don't have a large enough sample size to assure that you've got a good read on the population. If you take that sampling right outside of Golden Corral on all-you-could-eat chocolate fountain night or whatever, you're really unlikely that your 8 samples are going to be informative. So people that deal in terms of populations and distributions, they're all about the sample size. If you see 2 quantitative geneticists having a discussion, they're reading a paper, the first thing that they'll say is, well, what's the N? N corresponds to the number of individuals that were included in the sample. An N of 10,000 is great. An N of 10, not so much. So whenever you see distribution curves, and this is true if you're interested in biomedical sciences, whenever they do clinical tests or they do meta-analyses where they look at certain traits, you want to see something up in the thousands, ideally, to be enough to factor out outliers. And we'll talk about outliers in a bit. Okay. Hopefully you guys are good with some of this terminology, but just in case, since quantitative genetics is about stats, we need to make sure that you're good with some stats. Mean is the average. If you value or add up all of the individual values and then divide them by the number of individuals, that will give you the mean. The median is the point at which half the number in the population has values equal or above, half will have values equal or below. That's the median. The mean is just add them up, divide by the number of individuals, what's the average value. Variation is within that population, how much do individuals vary from that mean? You can have, let me just see if it's the next slide. So you can have curves, they could still be bell-shaped curves, but they've got dramatically different forms. You can have sort of a more gentle one, right? You can have one that looks like that, and you can have one that's really fairly sharp curve. All 3 of these would be normal-shaped curves. The means would, the means would all be essentially the same. But that range from, you know, certain parts of the population, how far away they are from this mean, is the amount of variability. So here it's less, here it's a lot less. Okay? And the way that we measure that is with standard deviation. And standard deviation is the square root of variance. You're not going to have to calculate standard deviation on this test. Don't worry about that. You get to do that in labs enough if you're a biology major. But what I want you to know is when we look at a population, the link between standard deviations and what part of the population you're catching. Okay. So in a normal shaped curve, if we start at the mean and we move plus 1 standard deviation and minus 1 standard deviation. Okay? So figure out what the mean is, figure out what the standard deviation is. If the mean, we'll just pick arbitrary numbers. If we're doing like carat mass or something like that, if the mean is 14, okay, and the standard deviation is 3, okay, the mean plus and minus 1 standard deviation would give you a range from 11 to 17. Okay? That should include 66% of the population will be within that range. Okay? If you do the mean plus or minus 2 standard deviations, okay, so you'd be looking at 8 to 20, that should cover 95% of the population. Okay? And that's kind of a hallmark. And the sciences, 95% is a big deal. If a scientist ever tells you that something is significant, it means there's a 95% probability that they're not wrong on that. that if they see a finding, for it to be significant, it's got to be 95% likely. If you've got values, if you do an experiment and you get a value that is more than two standard deviations away from the mean, it can be referred to as an outlier, and you can remove that point from your calculations. You can reasonably assume that something went wrong in that version of the experiment, and you can toss it out. Okay? But keep in mind, the standard deviation is linked to the variability. If you've got an experiment where values are all over the place, your value for standard deviation is going to be huge. So it's not like you're looking at, oh, I've got values that are all over the place, and this one's just slightly worse. It's going to be two standard deviations away. I can lose it. That's not the case. It's going to be, you're going to have a relatively tight grouping, and all of a sudden you've got this value that is just bizarre looking. You do a test to determine if it's two standard deviations away from the mean, declare it an outlier, and it gets to be excluded. And there are times when you're trying to get to your numbers clean enough that you can publish or you can write up your thesis that rule of outliers can save somebody. If they just pipetted 5 microliters instead of 0.5 microliters, got a bizarre result, they don't have to live with that anymore if they can show that it's a statistical anomaly. So plus or minus 2 standard deviations is 95%. And then if you go plus or minus 3, so we would do 5 to 23, that catches 99%. Okay. So if we think in terms of this, and we go from carrots to something like human height, right? 66% of the people in this room are within one standard deviation of the mean. So that's a good group, but we're still going to have a fairly large number of people that are outside of that. But if we go to two standard deviations, we catch almost everybody in this classroom by going out to two standard deviations. Okay? Then by going out to 3, you don't pick up that many more, but you pick up the bulk of the remainders. It's really unusual that you would see any type of experimentation that would go beyond 3 standard deviations. Most stop at 2 standard deviations. Okay? These numbers should, if you've got a true normal or bell-shaped curve, those numbers should always hold true. Okay? Whether it's a broad peak, a medium peak, or a narrow peak, it's the standard deviation itself, the value of the standard deviation will be larger in this one, smaller in this one, but those population percentages of the population of 66, 95, and 99 should always hold true if it's a true continuous characteristic. All right, correlation. Apologize. I took Latin. That was the language that I took when I was in high school, so I had 4 years of Latin. Then they tell me it's a dead language, so thanks a lot for that. But there's a saying in Latin that sort of pokes fun at a way of thinking. It's post hoc ergo propter hoc. It follows, therefore, it was caused by. And you see that a lot in pseudoscience, that A happened, then B happened, therefore A must have caused B. Okay? Or A and B happen at the same time. If A and B happen at the same time, they correlate. Correlation does not equal causation. Okay? You can get a lot of things that correlate, but one does not cause the other. And the tendency in human nature is if you see two things that correlate on a frequent basis, one of them has to cause the other. That's not true at all. That's really sloppy science. You have to demonstrate the actual mechanism. You just can't say these two things correlate, therefore they cause. One of them is caused. But there's some stats that you can do to determine how strongly things are correlated. It's referred to as a correlation coefficient. All I want you to know here is you do a curve, and if things, you'll generate a line. Okay? If there's a positive correlation, you'll get a line that points up and to the left. If it's a negative correlation, if it means if one thing happens, it makes it less likely that the other thing will happen with it, you go down and to the right, and you have a negative value. If the two things just happen independently, there's no connection between them, you'll just get a flat line. Okay? That just means they're not connected in any way. They happen independent of each other. With these two things, they're connected. In this case, if one happens, the other is more likely to happen. With the negative, if one happens, the other is less likely to happen. But they're still connected in some way. This way it's positively, this way it's negatively. No correlation means they're not connected at all. They're independent. That's all I want you to know about correlation is it's about they could be tied in with the same mechanism. It doesn't mean that one causes the other. Regression, you know, again, it's a very powerful form of stats. You're much more likely to run into it in ecology. If you take 201, they're going to make you learn to do regression analysis. I'm a molecular geneticist. Okay, I go in and I spend a lot of time manipulating the genetics of my system to make it different by one factor. I'll have two forms of bacteria that are different by one gene, and I put them under identical circumstances in my lab, and I do that so that I don't have to do regression analysis. I spend all that time pipetting little drops in little tubes so that I have one variable in my system. The expression of that gene, yes or no. Right? So for the most part, molecular biologists, the biggest stat that we ever have to do is the t-test. We have two things, one variable. Is the difference significant between those two? Okay? If you've got more variation in a system, if you're a field biologist, I started out as a field biologist, you've got a lot of variation. You've got the temperature at one site can be different than the other. The food abundance can be different. You've got a lot of variation. You have to enter all of those things and you do regression analysis with multivariable regression analysis to squeeze out the role of each individual variable in that system. If you are a molecular scientist, you manipulate the system so that you only have a single variable. Okay. Heritability. Heritability, it's kind of easy to confuse this with penetrance, but heritability is a combination of factors between genetics and the environment. What's the proportion of the total variability seen in a phenotype caused by genetics as opposed to the variation seen by other factors? So height. Right? If I take somebody that should be tall, but they're malnourished for the first 15 years of their life, they're not going to be that tall. Seen that with populations around the world where the average height has been much lower than Scandinavian countries tend to have the highest average height. I will go to my grave thinking the tallest population that I have ever seen, it's the tallest and blondest population that I have ever seen, is go to the IKEA in St. Paul, Minnesota. It's just like going back to Viking days. But the U.S. and Russia average really tall, fairly heavy people because we both had expanding frontiers that killed off small, frail people. And that selected for a larger body size in both the U.S. and Russia. But in other parts of the world right now, we have people of relatively small size, but now all of a sudden their access to food is much greater. And they're making huge jumps in one generation that can't be explained by genetics. It's the fact that most kids in these populations were malnourished during their entirety of childhood, and now they're actually getting adequate amounts of nutrition, and we're seeing what genetically the height of that population would be. So heritability is how much of the variation is determined by genetics. You don't need to learn those stats. This is just an example, and this is actually really similar to kind of stuff Diane Byers does. You've got here are some plants. If they're on top of the hill, they're exposed to wind. It dries out a little bit sooner. We've got tall. We've got short. And there is a distinction between these. But then when they grow down in the wetlands, The one that was tall up here is actually a little bit shorter. The one that was short up here is now taller. Genetically, they're the same genotype, but they've got dramatically different phenotypes based on the soil moisture. That's heritability. How much of that is determined by genetics? A little bit. Okay, but mostly you've got more variation that results from the environment. Okay, and then the last thing we'll talk about are QTLs. And QTLs are... Hey, give me just a minute, and then you can... They're all yours. Be as mean to this guy as you can. He's not a nice person. If you ever have kids and he shows up to date your daughter, don't let him. Plus, that'd be weird because they're... Oh, well. If you strike it rich and you're looking for a trophy wife 20 years from now. So QTLs are kind of looking for when you've got a trait that's got this variability. It's a continuous characteristic, and you're trying to find the genes that are involved. Okay, it's not that discrete case where we're looking for that one gene that encodes an enzyme. Yeah, does this thing encode that glycosyl transferase, yes or no? Now we're looking for, does this gene play any part in this continuous trait like height or the kernel color in wheat? And those are referred to as QTLs for a quantitative trait locus. And then you can kind of see that a geneticist would go in and map QTLs to determine how many different loci are involved in a trait. Looking for QTLs has changed dramatically in the era of genomics and bioinformatics. It's much easier now to go in and identify a gene that is probably involved in a quantitative trait if you've got the genome in hand. Before we had genomes in hand, searching for QTLs was a big portion of what was going on in genetics. And then the last thing is, again, that idea of selection. Mutation and how alleles segregate and assort during meiosis and during reproduction is variable and it's random. But selection is anything other than random. Okay? That by definition, selection means you're selecting for some traits as opposed to other. You can have natural selection in which, like I mentioned, with the U.S. and Russia, as you had that expanding frontier, that there was a selection for people of larger frame size, body size. That being able to, you know, carry larger pieces of wood or being able to survive periods of time in which you weren't going to be able to get calories, that was a strong selection. So you get this skewing in the population in the U.S. and Russia, where we tend to be bigger, have, you know, wider shoulders, wider hips. That would be a natural selection. But there's also artificial selection. It's often easier to manipulate a system through artificial selection. If you've ever seen what natural-looking corn looks like, the ears are, they're not even the size of, like, the, you know, baby corn from Big or whatever, you know, that you see in Asian food, those miniature. Teosinte is the ancestor of most corn that we have, and it looks almost like a yellow strawberry. And it's been through artificial selection that you get these relatively large, grotesque compared to their natural forerunner. There could have been natural selection events that would have selected for that, but it's been this constant selecting for bigger ears with bigger, more kernels. And so, but of course, the big example of that in a relatively short period of time is selective breeding for dogs. And of course, now on this, you could take all of these and make a miniature version that a rich girl can slap in her purse. So I'm just waiting on the, like, miniature German Shepherd version that is also a little guard dog in case anybody tries to take the purse. But in a relatively short period of time, we've gone from something like a wolf to all of this variation. Some of it's natural, most of it is artificial in nature. And until recently, dogs weren't bred for how they appeared. Most dogs were bred for doing a function. I mentioned before, like my favorite, beagles. They're bred to hunt rabbits and foxes. So they've got relatively big front paws to dig at rabbit holes. They got the big floppy ears because to protect their eardrums when they stick their heads in holes or as they're running through grasses. And they've got the little white tip on their tail so you could track them as they're running through grass. Right, so they're very functional. Bassets, really similar. Throw a beagle or a basset in the water, they don't like it. They're not swimming dogs. Retrievers tend to like water and they swim more. They've been bred selectively for those traits. Okay, so this is just showing how you can skew from the same starting point for high or low oil content in corn. You can do that. If you've got quantitative traits, you take the extremes, you keep breeding them, and you can make the range much larger and change the population. All right. I turn you over to the capable hands of Johnny.